Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today I'm talking to Lawrence Whitner, who is a professor of history at the State University of New York at Albany. Larry Whitner has received numerous honours and awards, including the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Program on Global Security and Sustainability Research and Writing Grant in 2002, Council on Peace Research in History, the Charles D. Benedetti Prize for the article Peace Movements and Foreign Policy. Throughout Larry Whitner's career, he's researched and written on the history of US foreign policy, international history, and the history of peace movements. Professor Whitner wrote a very important trilogy called The Struggle Against the Bomb, outlining the history of the whole anti-nuclear movement, and this was published by Stanford University Press. He, however, also wrote an abbreviated version, which is very accessible, called Confronting the Bomb, which is coming out this month in June, also published by Stanford University Press. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Larry.
Thank you, Helen. I'm delighted to be here.
So what sort of history did you study before you got into the world nuclear disarmament movement?
Well, I was always a historian of the United States,
yes.
But I realized that that wasn't really sufficient to deal with this worldwide phenomenon. So I decided to upgrade my knowledge a good deal by learning about other countries, from Finland to New Zealand, and their politics, their history, and particularly their peace movement.
And when did you make that decision?
Well, I actually began this project in the mid-80s. At that time, there was a conference being held by the Peace History Society, a group mostly in the United States of professional historians. And the decision was to hold a conference in Austria at the Castle Schleining in Schleining, Austria. And the idea of going to a castle for this professional conference sounded very exciting. So I looked around and tried to think of what sort of peace history topic could I write on. And I decided that since the movement against nuclear weapons was so dynamic and powerful at that time, that it was time somebody sat down and did a history of that movement. And I could do a paper at that conference and then continue that idea in a book. And eventually it became all three volumes of The Struggle Against the Bomb.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? Well, what sort of research did you do for this trilogy, Struggle Against the Bomb?
Oh, I did an enormous amount. I looked at the records of peace groups, and leaders of the peace movement around the world. I also managed to get to what had previously been top secret government records. They ceased to be top secret, of course, by that point. But I often was the first person to actually look at these things. The records of governments like those of the United States and Britain, the Soviet Union, and even East Germany. I interviewed peace movement leaders, including yourself, and also government officials, people like Caspar Weinberger and Richard Perle.
Goodness me.
And Zbigniew Brzezinski, James Baker, Max Kampelman, all sorts of Bush and Reagan and also Carter administration.
Major players in setting up and continuing the nuclear arms race.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of them weren't very helpful, but others actually were very interesting and were happy to talk about their role and what they felt was a successful campaign on their part.
Well, then, what you looked at these records that were previously unread by people such as yourself, Larry Whitner. Were they CIA records? Were they intelligence records in the countries you mentioned? What sort of records were they, A, and B, how did you gain access to look at them?
Well, different countries have different rules for releasing their records.
Mm.
The United States used to have a 20-year rule. Now it's a 30-year rule, or closer to that in any case, meaning that after 20 years, the government opens its files to researchers. Now, in fact, there are all sorts of qualifications on that, so that most CIA files remain closed, for example. But some CIA records are opened up. Most, but not all, State Department records are opened. And there are even Pentagon records that are opened up. So I did see a lot of those things. Generally speaking, it was... Well, more records were available the further back one went, so that when it came to the Roosevelt and Truman administrations, for example, I could see virtually anything.
Mm.
When it came to the Reagan administration records, I could see very little. I think at that point, only about 6% of the administration's or the White House records were open at the Reagan Library. When it came to the Soviet Union, of course, I was helped by virtue of the fact that the Soviet government collapsed.
Yes.
And therefore, the files were at least technically open. But practically, they were very difficult to get at. There were all sorts of restrictions, and these restrictions would change over time. And furthermore, there were severe language difficulties, at least for me, since I didn't read Russian.
Mm.
And, of course, the East German government also collapsed, and that made it much simpler to get at its files, including files of the Stasi.
Of the Stasi, wow.
Yes, right, the East German secret police.
How amazing.
Much dreaded. But, of course, with the fall of the government, those files were now open.
Oh.
And a good friend of mine who lived in the East and who was doing research there, was eager to see those files, especially the files showing investigation and spying on East German dissidents, mm. including East German peace groups.
Mm.
And so suddenly here were all these files.
Goodness me.
By East German spies on the East German peace movement, as well as on the Western peace movement, too.
Oh, really?
They were spying on END, European Nuclear Disarmament. And spying on people like E.P. Thompson.
And what about
Mary Caldor?
And what about Petra Kelly?
Spying on her too, of course. They absolutely hated her.
Why did they hate her so much?
Well, they hated her because she didn't adopt the official pro-Warsaw Pact line, which is to say the assumption that everything the West did was evil, and everything the East did was good. So this non-aligned, independent movement that was led by people like Petra Kelly was simply anathema to the East German government.
Yes, for those who don't know, Petra Kelly was one of the founders of the Green Party in Germany, West Germany, and the Bundestag. And I remember when they entered the Bundestag for the first time, they were dressed kind of as greens, and they carried branches of trees in with them, but Petra was such a dynamic person. Now, did you get access to the KGB files, Larry Whitner?
No, I didn't. On the other hand, there were KGB reports in the East German government files.
Oh, really?
So I saw those. And There were at times references to the KGB in the Soviet government files, and also there have been revelations by former KGB agents in published form, and so I could look at those and see what the KGB was doing at half the time.
And in particular, I'm interested, of course, in the FBI, CIA, NSA, Pentagon, State Department files on the peace movement, and people like me. I know that we've requested the CIA files on me and FBI, but they're being very difficult, and we're hardly getting anything. And when we get it, a lot of it's blacked out. What did you find? I mean, were they clever at spying? Did they know what we were up to, or is it a lot of it clumsy stuff? Or what did you find, Larry?
Well, I actually didn't get to very many of those files, since, as you just stated, they're very careful about releasing them. In short, they don't release very much. But on the other hand, occasionally I would stumble on those sorts of things. For example, I stumbled on little photocopies of Albert Schweitzer's private correspondence that were in U.S. government files, and in the files of Louis Strauss, who was chair of the Atomic Energy Commission.
I wonder how they got
during
them.
The Eisenhower administration.
Yeah.
Right, right. And I also read in biographies of Schweitzer that he believed that the CIA was spying on him and so on. Well, it clearly was. Somebody was getting his copies of his secret correspondence and passing them along to the U.S. government. So I think that must have been the CIA. Furthermore, there are reports in various memoirs, including one by Robert Gates, who is now Secretary of Defense, in which he states in these memoirs that he tried to convince he and other CIA officials at that time. He was deputy director of the CIA at that point. He and other CIA officials tried to convince the rest of the Reagan administration that there was nothing to the notion that Soviet money and Soviet influence was behind the U.S. peace movement and the non-aligned peace movement. Speaking. But the Reagan administration resisted and was determined to proceed, at least for a time, with its rather warped view that the U.S. peace movement was just a reflection of Soviet foreign policy.
Yes, I was often accused of being a communist in those years during the 80s. And when I actually went to see Reagan in the White House with his daughter Patty Davis, and I spent an hour and a quarter with him, she told me that he thought she was a communist, his own daughter, and that he really, as for being a good father, needed to hear her point of view. And so that's why he was open to talking to me, because he obviously thought I was a communist.
Right. Well, unfortunately, Reagan seems to have had a very warped view of the peace movement.
Yes,
at that time.
And yet he sort of joined it. I mean, I thought I'd had no influence at all on the man, who was almost totally ignorant about any nature of the nuclear weapons issue, numbers, strategies, technologies and the like. But, you know, afterwards he started saying nuclear war must never be fought and could never be won, and eventually started working with Gorbachev. So you never know, do you, Larry Whitner, what might occur?
Right. Well, in fact, when I began this study back during the mid-80s, my assumption was that the movement, which is, as far as I could tell, was the greatest mass movement, social movement of modern times, had failed. There had been no apparent progress toward nuclear arms control and disarmament that I saw. Certainly, the nuclear arms race was on. Threats of nuclear war were ever present. And yet when I started going into the files of the government, this government, the Soviet government, and so on, and interviewing government officials, what I found was just the reverse, that they were very worried about the movement, not only because it was interfering with their priorities, but because it was mobilizing the public against their nuclear ambitions. And therefore, they were forced, against their will, to begin to modify their views and to draw back from the brink of nuclear war and to begin to move down the path of arms control and disarmament.
Why does the U.S. government not allow access for historians such as yourself to the files for 30 years? What on earth is that all about, Larry?
Well, there are so-called national security concerns.
Like what? Like what?
Well, they want to hide what they're really doing.
Why?
They claim that's not because they want to hide it from historians or researchers, but because they don't want the enemy to know what they're doing. But in fact, the reality often is that they basically don't want the public to know what they're doing, and that's why they maintain secrets long after the enemy has disappeared. For example, the bulk of the files at the Reagan Library out in Simi Valley, California, are still closed, despite the fact that the enemy, the Soviet Union, no longer exists.
That's ridiculous, isn't it? Did you find that they got intrusive into, you know, peace movement activists' private affairs? I mean, you know, I'm sure my phone was tapped for years. In fact, I used to hear funny clicks and stuff, and I used to talk to them. I'd say, "Hello, CIA," you know, because I didn't care what they heard. But did they get quite intrusive into people's private lives, Larry Whitner?
Oh, absolutely.
In what way?
Particularly, well, they would spy on them. They would surveil their mail. They would
really.
Interview other people about them. They would tap their phone conversations. In Britain, for example, this was handily exposed when one of the MI5 agents,
yeah.
one of the top British intelligence agencies, one of the agents simply went to the press, went to The Guardian, and had long articles in it exposing just what was going on in terms of phone tapping CND leaders, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament leaders in Britain, and placing spies in CND headquarters and so on.
Ah, yeah. Well, I think my organization was infiltrated. In fact, when I left PSR after a coup d'etat in 1983, I spoke to John Stockwell, who formerly was high up in the CIA. And he said, look, what happened to you was a classical operation, but you'll never find out.
Right, right.
So they're...
Well, it's very difficult to know because they don't want people to know.
They're up to various nefarious activities, which, anyway, that's all retrospective now. But now tell us about the people, the officials that you got to interview, Larry Whitner, in America, in the United States, the ones who are very helpful, and what sort of attitudes did they have? What did they talk about in particular?
Well, in general, they were very proud of what they had done. They felt they had safeguarded the national security and through their hard line on nuclear weapons.
And for their preparation for nuclear war.
yes, they were. They were very enthusiastic about that and felt they did a good job. But I would question them on what had happened, particularly how they related, how they responded to a nuclear disarmament group.
Yeah.
And what I often found out was that they had been very concerned about these groups. Some, to be sure, said they were not. Let me give you one example. In terms of the Reagan administration, clearly with peace breaking out all over the world, or at least peace movement activities breaking out all over the world in the early 1980s, including the nuclear freeze campaign in the United States, which had gotten major support by the general public. It had something like 75-80% I interviewed numerous administration officials, they would say, "Oh no, we didn't worry about them at all." Like Richard Pearl, for example.
Oh, Prince of Darkness.
Oh. he would say, "Well, we didn't care. We knew we would prevail, so we just moved down the path we wanted to move down."
Yeah.
So on.
Yeah.
And then I got to Robert McFarlane, who was the assistant national led security advisor during the early 80s, and eventually became national led security advisor to Ronald Reagan. And I asked him about this, and he turned to me and he said, "You know," he said, "we took it very seriously." He said, "In fact, I was in charge of the administration campaign to counter the freeze at that time."
Oh, my God.
"And I worked closely with officials from the CIA, from the FBI, from the National Security Agency, from the State Department, and so on down the line." And he said, "I would get these officials together, and they would send them out on the road, and they had to conduct so many interviews with the press wherever they went, and get on so many talk shows, and so on and so on. And then they would get back to me." It was a very organized campaign.
God.
And it included speeches by Ronald Reagan. It included speeches by Caspar Weinberger, and so on. So they certainly did react very strongly to the campaign and did their best to offset it. Now, almost the next day, I spoke to Edwin Meese, who was the, the White House chief of staff during the early 80s, and then went on to become attorney general under Reagan. And I asked him about this, and he said the usual thing: "Oh, we didn't worry about them," and so on and so on. So I decided to push him somewhat further, and I said, "Well, Mr. Meese, I just talked to Robert McFarlane the other day, and he told me he was in charge of a major administration campaign." And Meese was silent for a moment, and he then said, "Well, if Bud says that's so, that's true."
So they lie.
Bud McFarlane.
Yeah, they lie openly, yeah.
Right.
Well, what we suspected is true, and I'm sure they infiltrated our groups. And I can't tell you how my animosity towards them for doing that, when, you know, the whole of life on Earth was at stake. But anyway, are there any other particular experiences you'd like to describe? Discovery of Japanese government duplicity?
Oh, yes, that's a good one to discuss. The fact is, the more I dug into U.S. government records, the more I found out about other governments, too. I never got to look through the Japanese government's files, but of course it was secretly corresponding with the U.S. State Department during the 1950s and 1960s, and I could see those files and see the Japanese letters and records of meetings with Japanese officials. And one of the striking things about the Japanese government's revelations to the U.S. State Department was that on the one hand, the Japanese government was calling for nuclear disarmament at that time, and calling for a halt to U.S. nuclear tests, among other nuclear tests at that time. And at the same time, the Japanese government was secretly telling the U.S. government, "We're very sorry we've made these statements, but we had to do it. Our public is so restless at this point and so hostile to nuclear weapons, and the peace movement here is so strong that we're forced to throw these SOPs out to public opinion. But, of course, we don't really believe it at all."
God almighty.
So, in short, the Japanese government was being very duplicitous at the time and was determined to both stave off popular pressure by saying they were for peace and they were for disarmament, and at the same time stay in the good graces of the U.S.
Oh, I'm sure this happens very frequently in international relations. So, right. Larry Whitner, I'm interviewing Professor Larry Whitner, who is a professor of history at the State University of New York in Albany. What were your conclusions when you finished the trilogy, Struggle Against the Bomb?
Well, as I mentioned, I began assuming that the movement had failed.
Mm.
But I was, as I found out, I was being far too quick in drawing that conclusion, and not subtle enough in asking the right questions. The right question was not, is the bomb still with us? The right question was, has the nuclear arms race been constrained by the anti-nuclear movement?
Yeah.
And has nuclear war been averted since 1945 because of peace movement pressure?
Yeah.
And I concluded positively in terms of
Did
the last
really?
Question.
Huh.
In short, the nuclear arms race was curbed and nuclear war was averted in large part due to peace movement pressure.
Okay, so just bring us up to date now in your thinking. We've got President Obama calling for abolition of nuclear weapons between Russia and America. And let's face it, they're the two rogue states at the moment threatening the world with annihilation. No other country has as many weapons as they do, and they both have a policy to, you know, launch on warning thousands of hydrogen bombs, which would mean probably nuclear winter and the end of all. So tell us then your take on the present situation and how that ties in with the anti-nuclear movement of the 80s.
Yes. Well, I think that one of the striking things about Obama's call for nuclear-free world is that even portions of the establishment now, even government officials and many former government officials, have concluded that a world bristling with nuclear weapons is simply too dangerous. And so, for example, the so-called Gang of Four, George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, William Perry, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, and Sam Nunn, who headed the U.S. Senate Armed Services Committee, came out with op-ed pieces in the Wall Street Journal in 2007 and 2008 calling for a nuclear-free world. Now, they didn't call for it overnight, but they did say that the world had become too dangerous for governments to be complacent any longer with the maintenance of nuclear arsenals. And therefore, they call for a range of intermediate steps as well as the goal of a nuclear-free world. And comparable groups have been of former government officials have been speaking out along similar lines in Britain and elsewhere, and that's even begun to percolate up into current governments. And I think Obama, recognizing that it had become feasible to now talk about a nuclear-free world, has begun to talk about that sort of thing. He did talk about it during his campaign. Mm-hmm. He talked about it on his website. And furthermore, in Prague during April, mm-hmm. he made a very powerful speech calling for a nuclear-free world and saying that his administration was committed to that.
Do you think then, Larry Whitner, that Obama was influenced in his 20s by the anti-nuclear movement, which was so powerful in America in the 1980s?
You know, I don't know, but certainly that's quite powerful. After all, he was going to Columbia College, wasn't
yeah.
he? My own alma mater, as a matter of fact. Just at the time when the anti-nuclear movement was at its peak, and therefore I'm certain he had a powerful influence upon him by the anti-nuclear movement. Just as Mikhail Gorbachev was a student at the time when powerful criticisms were being made of the nuclear arms race. So that I think that he's an example of how the movement long term has affected people and finally affected governments.
Yes, well, I do know John Holdren, his science advisor, is powerfully in favor of abolition of nuclear weapons. So that's a good sign too. Larry, in the trilogy, you write of three upsurges of protest, I guess, since 1945 when they built the first bombs. And when did these three upsurges occur and what exactly triggered them?
Well, in each case, a sense of nuclear danger. The first developed in the late 1940s after the first use of the atomic bomb by the U.S. government to destroy Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we frequently forget, I think, how powerful the use of the bombs affected public opinion at that time. There was, of course, great support for the use of the bomb by the non-Axis powers. I know certainly there was in Australia and in the United States and so on, but the public was also frightened by the bombs, seeing that a single nuclear weapon could destroy a major city. And therefore, they developed the well-founded caution about nuclear weapons. They understood for the first time that a single weapon could be used to destroy their city. And if future war took place, certainly another world war, that this world war with nuclear weapons would destroy civilization. And therefore, from the start, from 1945 on, there was a growing public sense that a nuclear war had to be averted somehow. Mm. And that movement grew during the late 1940s.
Yep. Now, what was the second upsurge?
The second upsurge, well, let me just add that The first upsurge declined as the Cold War intensified, and increasingly people felt that there was no alternative to at least developing nuclear weapons. So people became more passive, and the public criticism of the bomb died down, although people were still not enthralled with the prospect of war.
Being vaporized.
right. But they often thought, nonetheless, that if their country had the bomb, if we Britons had the bomb, say, then the Soviet Union would not dare to attack us. That would deter the evil Soviet Union. So they made their peace with the bomb to some degree. However, during the 1950s and early 1960s, especially the late 1950s and early 1960s, there developed a second surge of opposition to the bomb. And it was triggered by hydrogen bomb tests. The hydrogen bomb, of course, is 1,000 times more powerful than the atomic bomb, meaning it's ever more dangerous than the atomic bomb. So if the atomic bomb frightened people, the hydrogen bomb absolutely terrified them. And indeed, from the start, these nuclear tests were out of control. They scattered nuclear radiation, so-called fallout, around the world. And particularly on a Japanese fishing boat, hundreds of miles away from the U.S. nuclear testing site in the Pacific, the misnamed Lucky Dragon, and when that ship came back to Japan, it was highly radiated. The crew was suffering from radiation sickness. Its fish were radioactive, and the Japanese went into a panic. But it wasn't just the Japanese. The whole world could see what nuclear testing did to the atmosphere. So on two levels, nuclear tests were viewed as particularly awful on the basis that they were preparations for nuclear war of 1,000 times the power of the past. And furthermore, that even if the war didn't take place, just the testing of nuclear weapons resulted in massive radioactivity, and therefore cancer and birth defects around the world. So people began to protest against these nuclear tests. Groups like SANE, the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy, developed in the United States, the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Great Britain, movement against atomic arms in France, and so on around the world. And this movement actually led to the Partial Test Ban Treaty, the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty of 1963. But with some sense that progress was being made, that the great powers had gotten a handle on the nuclear problem, and they were going to move further toward nuclear arms control and disarmament, the movement declined. And indeed, the upfront threat of nuclear war declined also, since the United States and the Soviet Union began a period of détente. But another surge of protests developed during the late 1970s and early 1980s. That was in part thanks to the dangers of nuclear power. Catastrophes such as the Three Mile Island near Meltdown, as well as the general leakage of radioactivity from nuclear power plants around the world, as well as uranium mining and other things linked to the processing of nuclear materials, meant that many people had the nuclear question rubbed in their face once more. Furthermore, the Cold War revived. It began during the late 1970s as both the Soviet Union and the United States escalated the nuclear arms race, but it was certainly very prominent during the early 1980s as the Reagan administration spurred forward the nuclear buildup and began to threaten nuclear war and to say that a nuclear war could be won. And therefore, millions of people began to turn out in the streets. This was the biggest anti-nuclear movement yet, and as I said, it had a very substantial impact.
Yeah. I'm interviewing Larry Whitner, who's a professor of history at the State University of New York in Albany. So what was the reaction when the Struggle Against the Bomb trilogy was published, Larry Whitner?
Well, I was struck by the fact that on the one hand, I'd written three unique books that for the first time got down to nitty-gritty of government records, interviews with government officials, interviews with leading peace movement figures, and so on, and books that were also dealing with perhaps the greatest threat of our time, nuclear war. And yet the mass media simply ignored
it. Really?
Yes, they drew rave reviews in scholarly journals and in peace movement publications and in some political magazines like the Progressive. But when it came to the mass media, there was almost a total
silence,
blackout,
including the New York Times. Why do you think that's so?
Well, I think it's so because the mass media don't want to deal with the major point that these books made, namely that it was the peace movement that saved the world from nuclear war, and the mass media are simply too establishment oriented to go for that.
But how do you mean? I mean, this is history, And, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't have wanted to be vaporized in a nuclear war, or their presses would have been destroyed and the like. What on earth are they up to, Larry? I don't understand this philosophy at all.
Well, I think they're too hooked in to government policies. They're too hooked in to the corporations. They're too hooked in to conventional wisdom to accept what is, after all, an avant-garde view, even though it's buttressed with hundreds of interviews and research in all the proper places.
Yeah.
So although scholars think the struggle against the bomb is the greatest thing since sliced bread, the fact is that the mass media, for the most part, wouldn't touch it.
Oh, that's pathetic. Well, okay, so the next issue is, why have you written the abbreviated version, Confronting the Bomb, that's coming out this month by Stanford University Press? And is there a revival of the nuclear disarmament movement today? Why did you write the book, and what's going on, Larry?
Well, I wrote it because, as I implied in my previous comments, I was very frustrated by the fact that the Struggle Against the Bomb trilogy was largely confined, and its findings were largely confined to scholars.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine to reach scholars, but I wanted to reach the general public, and I wanted the public to understand that it's thanks to their work, it's thanks to their opposition to nuclear weapons, it's thanks to their speaking out that the world has been saved from nuclear war, and in the future, it's thanks to their speaking out that might lead to a nuclear-free world. And so I decided that I needed to write a more popular version, and that version would not be three thick scholarly volumes, but one slim book without footnotes or other scholarly apparatus that would be in paperback form and relatively inexpensive.
All right, so everyone must rush out and buy it. They all must rush out.
Yes, they should, I think.
So, all right, tell us about today. What's your view of the nuclear disarmament movement, particularly in the United States? And if they're, you know, if it isn't very active, why or why not? You know, what's going on?
Well, I think that with the collapse of the Cold War and the sense of real progress toward arms control and disarmament, there was a falling off of activism, and many of those millions of people went home to cultivate their gardens or just to breathe a sigh of relief. But the fact is that 27,000 nuclear weapons continue to exist around the world, with thousands of them on a hair trigger alert today. And there are still groups that are continuing the struggle, groups like Peace Action, the largest peace group in the United States, or Physicians for Social Responsibility, a group which you did so much to energize during the late 1970s and early 1980s. These groups, plus smaller groups like the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and others as well, have remained concerned about the nuclear arms race, have remained concerned about the nuclear danger, and are now mobilizing, trying to bring a popular pressure to bear on governments at this new period of not only danger, but opportunity to begin to make real progress toward a nuclear-free world. And so they're now mobilizing not only to see to it that the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was signed by President Clinton but never ratified by the U.S. Senate, finally gets ratified in the next year or so. And furthermore, that these stepping stones, like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, actually move on toward a nuclear-free world. And they're pushing particularly to have the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference of 2010, May 2010, focus on a treaty for nuclear abolition. That is, not simply talking about stepping stones anymore, but actually developing a treaty signed by all nations with enforcement mechanism to abolish nuclear weapons. And so if the public joins that campaign, I think it has a real chance.
Yes, and I think that I can't remember what President Roosevelt said, but some people came in to convince him of something, and he became convinced. And then he said to them, now you've got to go out and make sure that I can do this, because all presidents who set out, like Roosevelt in certain areas or Obama in this area of nuclear abolition, must have total support of the public behind them, right?
Right, absolutely. Obama said something just like that. He said that, if you really want these things, you're going to have to keep pushing me, and so on. And in fact, I had a very similar conversation with Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who worked in the Kennedy administration and was a speechwriter for Kennedy. And I asked Schlesinger before his recent death, how did the Kennedy administration view the peace movement, my usual question for government officials? And he said, well, Kennedy viewed them as very useful in terms of offsetting pressure he was getting from the hawk in the U.S. Senate and in the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so on. So he looked fondly on this peace movement pressure as a means of actually pushing him toward a test ban treaty and mobilizing the public behind that test ban treaty, as he finally managed to do.
So, Larry Whitner, given the public's abhorrence of nuclear weapons, what is the pathology within these government officials and corporate officials and the like to continue the nuclear arms race or not get rid of these incredible... I mean, they're not really weapons. They're like exploding small suns all over the earth. I mean, what is their pathology? Just what is it?
Well, I think we sometimes forget that nuclear weapons are part of the war system, the weapons of war. Now, they're too dangerous to use, in my view, but nonetheless, for thousands of years, people in competing territories, rival cave groups, for example, people in Cave A and in Cave B, were frightened of one another, and they learned to carry clubs, and if the people in Cave A gave them any trouble, the people in Cave B would hit them with their clubs, and people in Cave A would get bigger clubs and then spears, and then eventually they would develop bows and arrows and so on down the line. So they came up with gunpowder and cannons and bombers and nuclear weapons finally. So that nuclear weapons are just the latest instrument in this competition among competing territories and our day competing nation states. And therefore, on the one hand, government officials understand that nuclear war means a planetary doom. And on the other hand, they continue to do what government officials have always done, what rival territories have always done. They develop the biggest and most dangerous weapons they can because they don't trust other nations and they want to have their way in world affairs. And so it seems to me the solution to this problem has two parts. The first part is we have to press for arms control and disarmament through popular pressure, through supporting peace groups and their anti-nuclear campaigns, so that government officials reluctantly accept some measure of arms control and disarmament. But we also have to keep our eye on the fact that probably government officials will never move to get rid of all their nuclear weapons until the problem of war is dealt with.
Yeah.
Until there's some sense of international security.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's not surprising in a way that the nuclear disarmament campaign is part of the peace movement campaign.
Yeah.
Because ultimately,
it's a very good point, and I think it's actually the testosterone factor that persists throughout human history, and one that now has to be curbed and subjugated, because we've reached the end point. We can't have war anymore with nuclear weapons. But the point is that Obama, although he'd like to get rid of nuclear weapons, he's using those drones in Pakistan and Afghanistan, shooting down from computerized planes, unmanned vehicles, you know, and killing wedding parties and villages and maybe some Taliban here and there. I do not understand the duplicity or the, I don't know what other word to use, whereby he clearly is a man of peace and he clearly wants to negotiate and conduct diplomatic overtures with difficult countries. But I don't understand what he's up to in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Do you?
Well, I understand it, although I don't support it. I think war is a very bad habit, and using military force,
especially for those who get killed,
right, is part of that. And you know, the world hasn't broken the war habit yet. It's recognized that that habit is very bad for it, that it has all kinds of negative consequences, but it's not quite willing to stop it yet. It's comparable to people smoking in that sense. They know it's bad for them, but they haven't quite steeled themselves to make that break, and they're going to have to do it.
Recovered from the addiction.
Right.
Now, let's move on quickly. How can people become more involved in the current nuclear disarmament movement, Larry Whitner?
Well, they can look up their peace group in their community, or just look them up on their website on the computer. In the United States, the major or largest peace groups are groups like Peace Action, which is actually the descendant of SANE and the Nuclear Freeze Campaign, which merged years back to form Peace Action. Mm. There are other groups like Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Faithful Security, and other groups.
And Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament.
Yes, yes. So there are many peace groups, and I think people should recognize that they shouldn't be armchair peace supporters, that they have to get out there and actually join these groups and support them with their dues money and do the job. It's not simply a matter of complaining about government militarism. It's a matter of protesting against that militarism.
Yes, and I think...
And bringing it to an end.
I think the churches have an incredibly important role to play, because Jesus was the ultimate peacemaker, and, you know, Buddha and all the rest are the religions.
Right.
So it's people's moral obligation, I think, for them to get their churches on the right track, as happened during the 80s with the Catholic bishops' pastoral letter and the Methodist bishops' pastoral letter. So it's getting off the couch, and it's becoming actively involved in the democracy, supporting Obama, and finally moving beyond war. And I am very interested in the subject of why men kill, but that's something else that we could do another whole show on. Now, Larry Whitner, how do people obtain a copy of your wonderful new book, Confronting the Bomb, which is in paperback now?
Yes, it's just come out this month. It's published by Stanford University Press, and people can go to the Stanford website, which is www.sup.org. Or they can order it from online bookstores, or they can go to their local bookstore and simply tell the bookstore management to order that book. It is in a cloth edition, too, but I suspect most of your listeners will prefer the paperback, which is really quite inexpensive.
That's wonderful. Well, look, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation, Larry Whitner, and I appreciate so much the work that you've done and the time you've put into documenting the whole anti-nuclear movement since the 1940s. And your work, although it may have been ignored by the mainstream media, will become absolutely classical works that will be referred to, if we survive and if we stop this nuclear madness, by all of future generations hence.
Well, thank you very much, Helen. And you've certainly done your work for the anti-nuclear campaign, too.
Yeah.
So I salute you as well.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you. I've just been interviewing Lawrence Whitner, who's a professor of history at the State University of New York at Albany. Professor Whitner wrote a very important trilogy called The Struggle Against the Bomb, outlining the history of the whole anti-nuclear movement, and this was published by Stanford University Press. He, however, also wrote an abbreviated version, which is very accessible, called Confronting the Bomb, which is coming out this month in June, also published by Stanford University Press. Don't forget, if you'd like to support us, you can go to the webpage ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and there is a place where you can make donations, which would be very gratefully accepted. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week on If You Love This Planet.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.